Thank you very much. Let me begin also by thanking Ingrid Gregg and the members of the Philadelphia Society for the invitation to be here and to present a few thoughts this morning. My reflections are simply entitled Tensions in the Idea of Political Economy, and I will be addressing kind of the broad parameters of the concept of political economy. So let me begin by noting the extent to which the term political economy is not a term that would be recognized in classical political thought. In fact, economics, or the economy, is located by Aristotle as part of the household, the oikos. From there we get the term economy, that by which the household lives. That's the private world, the world that's set aside. The last thing that the classical thinkers, Aristotle in particular, wanted to do was to elevate, you could say, the material conditions of existence, the means by which the household lived, to the public realm as an end of politics in itself, an end of the polis. The polis was the visible, the household was the invisible. And that theme obviously echoes the question of visibility that Adam Smith eventually resurrects. Now, the reality, of course, is that the Greek world had an economy. They had the Piraeus. They knew about buying and selling. They knew about markets. They knew about cornering markets. They knew about monopolies. They knew, you know. So these were certainly events that they could observe. But at no point does it get elevated to what we would call a theoretical perspective in which it comes into view. And that explains a good deal, I think, of the uncertainty or the ambivalence that Professor Lloyd mentions in regard to the founders. That, yes, the good case can be made that they understood this and made economic welfare and development central, but having a classical education didn't prepare them well for it. They, in a sense, had to ignore what they read about in the classic texts. This is not just a purely American problem. It's also one, of course, that the medieval thinkers had. It's always instructive to see the way in which the scholastics, who were living at a time when the new cities were thriving, the free cities, where free enterprise, buying and selling, exchange of all types was flourishing, and they could see that they, you know, were living in a time of great economic growth. Not all of it, but you know, they could observe the reality. And yet, they couldn't quite square that with the injunctions they found in Aristotle and elsewhere against things like buying and selling, but most of all, lending money at interest. St. Thomas has to go through a number of contortions, really, to make it permissible to charge interest. While the charging of interest, he said, was not really, in terms of justice, could not be excused, could not be legitimized. Nevertheless, you could repay interest as a friendly gesture. So when your credit card sends you your bill, you could regard the interest that you're sending back to them as a mere gesture of goodwill on your part, not a matter of pure justice or contract. Of course, the original capitalists, whenever I have to cover this, it's always a bit of a laugh to explain that the original capitalists were the monks, because these were guys who went to took something that was completely without value, a plot of land somewhere in an area that they'd been given for almost nothing, and told to work away on it. And over a period of time, of course, they developed it, it grew, it flourished. They became wealthy, and like good capitalists, they avoided consuming the wealth that they had generated. They plowed it all back into the business again. And so you have this same cycle of economic growth and expansion. Unfortunately, there's a limit to the amount of consumption you can defer, and the poor monks gradually consume more and more wine. You can follow the details and the amount they're permitted. You know, originally they only had one glass once a year, and then you know a couple of glasses a month, and then everybody got a bottle a day, and you know it was. these were the leading economic indicators of the time. But none of that really solves the question, which is how do you put together politics and economics? What really is the public and the political with the private and the individual? Even today, when we use this term political economy, it's not clear that we really have resolved how those two levels, you know, in a sense, are accommodated. I would suggest, indeed, that the conversation of the relationship between what politics should do about the economy and what the economy should do in relation to the political is an ongoing discussion, not by any means resolved. Particularly when you consider that the big insight that we have gained is that the economy flourishes when it is left alone, when it works autonomously, free from the political intervention, free from monopolies, mercantilist operations, and appropriations and confiscations of all types. Then you have a flourishing regime. On the other hand, no one seems to regard it as utterly, you could say, unmoored from its political context, from the political protections, the rule of law and so on, that seem essential to it. So on the one hand, we have this pursuit of private self-interest and private exchange and contract. On the other hand, we have a kind of collective public good, which is more than private and more than individual. And indeed, this is the topic of political economy, that we want to find a way of making the private and the collective, the public, harmonize, to find the right harmony, the right balance in these things. It's not altogether clear that we have reached that. Through a process of trial and error, have made some progress, but we're not quite at that level where we have found, you could say, an adequate intellectual formulation of it. That's in essence the challenge that I'd throw out. A few suggestions as to how the subject might be tackled. The first one is that we should be a little more hesitant about regarding economic activities as merely private, as merely individual, as merely a matter of free exchange between individuals. Because everything that we engage in there, while we pursue our self-interest, we in fact are building something more. If it is a system of exchange, then it's a social system. It's a system of mutual cooperation. If you think of the insurance business, we buy insurance out of self-interest, out of our private interests. But an insurance system is really a social system by which Again, in pursuing satisfactions from an individual perspective, we nevertheless also sustain something that's communal and that goes beyond the individual level. So what appears to be a private enterprise, and this is nothing to do whether it's government or private, all kinds of insurance function in this way. There's arguments that it's better in private hands and so on, but the essential thing is that our individual actions are not really our own. They also have this communal dimension to them. Smith, in identifying the invisible hand of the economy, where he talks about the benefits of exchange and the benefits of a system of commercial buying and selling, the division of labor and everything else that he goes into. He says that all of these goods are not delivered to you out of the benevolence of the participants, but out of their pursuit of their own individual profit. That's fine. But it's interesting that he uses the term an invisible hand is ultimately what sustains it. Of course, that metaphor has all of its own intriguing aspects. Including, whether the invisible hand might not be more real than the visible hands, why they might not have more of a substantive presence and reality than what we actually see. The market, in Smith's account, is, in other words, something invisible, and you could say his real contribution is to raise what really up to that point was largely unnoticed into the realm of the noticed, that which we recognize and talk about and so on. And it's out of that, of course, that we develop a notion of political economy, that indeed the political has a legitimate relationship to the economic, which seems to function quite outside of it and quite apart from it. A second suggestion that I would toss out here is that we can go beyond the realm of metaphors and think of the relationship between the political and the economic as a relationship that's ultimately transacted or negotiated within the person. That it's not a merely, that in a sense, the person is a term that is neither individual nor collective or public, but somehow capable of accommodating both. Not only do we have in economic activity individual or personal initiatives, but in the political, we equally have representation by persons. So that the crucial aspect of what's transacted at every level, whether we think of it as individual transactions in the economic sphere or political actions in the public sphere, turns ultimately on the persons who are responsible for them and who indeed invest themselves into those activities and to such an extent, really, that you could say the collective is what disappears. The personal is the point at which it is revealed or displayed. We, of course, have developed a whole language of thinking about that relationship between the individual and the collective in terms of rights, natural rights and human rights. This is a language that has served us well by particularly calling attention to the notion that the individual, the persons, are centers of meaning and value in the whole order of things that outweigh the collective at certain points, that in a sense place limits on what the collective can do, what the political can do, and in turn we recognize that they are the ones who sustain the whole. Parts and wholes is the typical way in which we think about members and collectives. But persons and the language of rights that revolves around persons is really a language in which the person comes into view, into our perspective, as transcending the whole. And indeed, that transcendence of the whole is one of the ways in which we can think about the relationship most fruitfully. The family is a whole, and it's a collection of persons. But it's a collection of persons that has really no goal, no purpose, other than sustaining its members. So that it's not a question of competing interests or clashing of interests so much as it's ultimately a question of each member standing for the whole and being in turn embraced by the whole. It's interesting that that Hegel, when he deals with the question of the state of commerce and the state of the market and the state, ultimately begins with the family as the first model of human association. Okay, the third point I just want to hit on in my concluding section is just to remind ourselves about the distinction that Michael Oakeshott made between what he called an enterprise association and a civil association. I've always thought that that's a particularly useful distinction because it highlights the way in which a civil association does something quite different from any other association of which we're a part, with the possible exception of the family, that Oakeshott neglects, as far as I know. In the civil association, we are not told what to do. We have no purpose other than pursuing our own purposes, our liberty. In the enterprise association, we join into some collective effort, some common effort, with you could say the explicit awareness that we are surrendering our liberty. This is why when you go to work for GM, you can't do anything you want. They tell you what you're going to do. But as a citizen, you are free to do what you wish within the law. The law does not tell you what to do. The law permits you to do what you want with your time. I want to suggest that Oakeshott's distinction, however valuable, overlooks the problem of the relationship between these two types of association, and that it may well be that you cannot think of an enterprise association where we have a common good that we aim at, a common object, a common purpose, individuals all bend their efforts towards that same goal, and they sacrifice for the sake of that purpose or that goal. Whether it's military or corporate or anything else, that such associations can hardly exist unless they are, you could say, enclosed by this broader form of association that Oakeshott has called the civil association. That it's only in the civil association that the individual, the person, is indeed accorded the fundamental respect and dignity from which they are owed, that no one controls their time or their resources or anything else, that they determine their own lives freely and everything else. That's the ultimate kind of guarantee that we give towards one another within the political community, and that really constitutes the essence of a civil association. And it's only, you could say, with that background in mind, that all enterprise associations are possible. Let me just return finally to Aristotle. Even though Aristotle had This is actually something that occurred to me on the plane here. you know, traveling on a plane is the most creative and useful time that you're stuck there. You have to sit in place and you can't look at anything else or turn on your phone or do anything. So you have to think. And it occurred to me that Aristotle actually does deal with economics outside of his dismissal of it as part of the household. It's in books 8 and 9 of the Ethics where Aristotle talks about the different forms of friendship. And this kind of goes with what Ryan Hanley was referring to. Aristotle deals famously with 3 different kinds of friendship. Friendships of utility, friendships of pleasure, and true friendships of mutual affection. Everything is oriented in the discussion towards true friendship, where friends love one another for their own sakes or serve one another for their own sakes. However, what's important is that when Aristotle talks about friendships of utility, he includes economic friendship within that, and that sort of characterizes what an economic exchange is. It's an exchange in which we find one another mutually useful. Now, the conventional way of reading that is to say, well, Aristotle regards that as such a low level of friendship. That's true. But when you think that really Aristotle's whole political theory is rooted in those 2 books on friendship, you realize that, yes, even the economic friendship, the friendship of utility, ultimately is subsumed into a higher idea of friendship as its ultimate truth. So it's never merely a question of utility. It's also a question of utility that points beyond itself and that therefore says, yes, we are useful to one another, but we don't regard one another as friends merely because we're useful.